and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Republican Senate delaying their vote on the repeal and replacement of Obamacare that Majority Leader Mitch McConnell was hoping to ram through before the 4th of July recess. A leading authority on healthcare and healthcare reform, Jonathan Oberlander, a professor of social medicine and health policy and management at the University of North Carolina, joins us. We will discuss the difficulty pleasing the demands of the libertarian wing who want to do away with any government role and the moderate Republican wing who don't want to see millions of citizens of their states lose health care coverage that they've only recently gained. We will look into the obvious truth about these bills that they are tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans at the expense of taking coverage away from our poorest citizens. And whether in the event that the Republicans get nothing done, we will be left with the probability that Obamacare will be slowly but surely undermined and killed by neglect and sabotage. Then we will speak with Marcia Gessen, the author of The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin. She is now a contributing editor for The New York Times, where she has an article, How Putin Seduced Oliver Stone and Trump. We will discuss her critique of the 4-hour-long interviews of Vladimir Putin that Oliver Stone made for Showtime, which were widely panned as a platform for Putin to parry sycophantic softball questions into a propaganda exercise. We'll also examine whether Putin's meddling in the U.S. election has backfired. And finally, we'll analyze a major shift in global attitudes about the United States reflected in the latest poll from the Pew Research Center that surveyed over 40,000 people in 37 countries to find that only two countries, Israel and Russia, have a better opinion of America under Trump, while 26 of the 37 countries consider Trump dangerous. Michael Fuchs, a former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State who was a special advisor to the Secretary of State and a member of the Secretary's policy planning staff, joins us to assess how far the U.S. has fallen in the estimation of the world since Trump became president. And joining us now is Jonathan Oberlander, a professor of social medicine and health policy and management at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, where he's also a professor in the Department of Political Science. A leading authority on the politics of healthcare and healthcare reform, he's the author of The Political Life of Medicare and co-editor of the 3-volume series, The Social Medicine Reader, now in its second edition. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jonathan Oberlander.
Thank you.
It looks as though the Senate has had to delay the healthcare vote. Mitch McConnell was trying to force it through before the 4th of July holiday. And now, of course, it'll mean that after Congress returns from the holiday, they'll have a 2-week window before the summer break. But it's not looking good. Now, my understanding is that Trump has invited all of the Republican senators over to the White House for a strategy session. But I'm told by a lot of Washington insiders, and particularly in the Senate, that the senators don't want to be too associated with Trump. He's kind of kryptonite as far as this healthcare bill is concerned. So is that going to help, having them over at the White House?
Well, you know, when your approval ratings as a president are in the mid-30s or thereabouts, the amount of pressure you can exert on members of Congress is limited. And from the beginning, this was going to be difficult to get through the Senate because Republicans can only afford to lose 2 votes, and it's a very narrow margin. And Leader McConnell has to satisfy conservatives like Rand Paul from Kentucky and Ron Johnson from Wisconsin, and moderates or less conservative Republicans like Heller in Nevada and Susan Collins in Maine. So it's a difficult road to hoe, and it's been a roller coaster. But we should remember that in the House, of course, the bill died before it was passed as well. So the final chapter has not been written yet.
Well, in both the House and the Senate, it looks as though the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office's scoring of the bills, really did have a detrimental effect. It seems like 22 million people losing their health insurance has certainly turned Susan Collins around.
Well, it's, I guess, reassuring if evidence and facts matter and reason in this. And the bottom line, what the CBO is saying in non-technical terms is that the Republican Party does not have a viable replacement plan. They do not have a plan to replace Obamacare that can ensure anything like the number of people that the Affordable Care Act can. And you can see that in their scores. And if you read through the CBO report, what you see is that the Senate Republican plan really would offer people quite inadequate coverage. Many people would lose insurance, and the kind of plans that would be available for the uninsured to purchase, the deductibles would be so staggeringly high that low-income Americans simply couldn't afford them. So it's a bad plan, and I think the CBO report reflects that.
So are the Republicans victims of rhetoric? I mean, they're obviously, if they get anything passed, they're going to make a lot of Americans victims of their politics, because this is never going to improve what Obama did. But it would make sense, given the flaws of Obamacare, to try and fix it, make it better, make it work better, as opposed to scuttle it and come up with something that's infinitely worse. What do you attribute all this to? I mean, it doesn't make any sense in the real world, but it just seems like the American people, and particularly those who are going to lose their healthcare coverage, are victims of political posturing.
The Republican Party in Congress has a visceral hatred of Obamacare, and they have been running against it since before it was passed. They have been campaigning to repeal it and fighting to undermine it for the past 7 years. And now they have a chance to do just that. And so part of this is a commitment to make good on their promise, as irrational as it is to actually carry that out. Part of it is partisan. Part of it is ideological, and this really reflects the ideological polarization in American politics. And Obamacare is, in key respects, a conservative plan. It looks a lot like what Republican health reform plans used to look like, and yet the Republican Party has moved so far to the right in Congress that now that plan is too liberal for them. And so part of it is that, and part of it is, I think, that Republicans the last 7 years have constructed an illusion of Obamacare, that Obamacare has destroyed American medical care, that everybody has lost their doctor and everybody's costs are going up and so forth. To be sure, there are real issues with Obamacare. There are real problems with it that absolutely need fixing. But it's also a fact that 20 million Americans have gained insurance coverage. It's also a fact that insurance companies have been prohibited from discriminating against people with pre-existing conditions, which is a huge change from what the status quo ante was. It's also a fact that in the 32 states that have expanded Medicaid, millions of low-income Americans who have gained coverage who simply couldn't afford it before. And their Republican illusion of Obamacare doesn't allow for these successes. And so when they go to strip Obamacare away, the idea is they're moving away from the system that's collapsing, the system that's dying. And the reality is very different. The reality is Obamacare is a flawed system, but has covered many people and has many successes. And as a result, Republicans are repealing something that means that millions of Americans are going to lose benefits.
And again, I'm speaking with Jonathan Oberlander, professor of social medicine and health policy and management at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, where he's also a professor in the Department of Political Science, a leading authority on the politics of healthcare and healthcare reform. He's the author of The Political Life of Medicare and co-editor of the three-volume series, The Social Medicine Reader, now in its second edition. Now, we know that Bernie Sanders has come out for single payer, and now Elizabeth Warren has joined him, saying it's time for Democrats to run on a single payer healthcare platform across the country. And as you mentioned, Obamacare was based on a conservative model, Mitt Romney's plan in Massachusetts. I mean, the Republicans think this is wonderful. They say this is going to really tank the Democrats. They haven't exactly taken it up. Nancy Pelosi sort of said she's in favor of single payer, but has not wanted to champion it. What do you think the chances are of Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren getting some traction here?
Well, I think it already has had traction. If you look in states like California, where there's a lot of momentum for single payer, certainly at the state level, this has caught fire in some states. And if you look at public opinion polls, there was a poll out, I think, from Pew just this past week showing that the percentage of Americans favoring single payer, while it's still a minority, and it, of course, depends on how you ask the question, it's jumped significantly among liberal Democrats. And so, you know, Elizabeth Warren, a potential presidential aspirant in 2020, it's significant that she's come out in favor of it, because single payer has not had a lot of support from establishment Democrats. And of course, Bernie Sanders ran for the Democratic nomination, but is actually not a Democrat. So I think it is going to gain traction in the liberal wing of the Democratic Party. The question is, can it gain much beyond there? And there, I think it's going to be more difficult. It depends in part on what happens to Obamacare. If Republicans in the House and Senate, the Senate passes something and Republicans in the House and Senate come to an agreement and they eviscerate much of Obamacare's insurance expansion, and if they make the kind of devastating cuts to Medicaid that are in both proposals that would adversely affect states and hospitals and physicians and millions of Americans who lose coverage, it will create more of an opening for single payer. I have no doubt about that. It will still be difficult to enact, but if the system sustains that kind of blow, there will be more of an opening. But in order for single payer to get beyond the liberal wing of the Democratic Party, it's got to reach a much broader audience, both in terms of the public and politically. And I think that remains the challenge for champions of Medicare for All.
But this Republican bill, whether it's the House or the Senate one, the one thing that's clear about both of them is that they're really about tax cuts for the rich. And what money they take away from Medicaid, they give back to the wealthiest Americans. And that's the one thing that survived in both bills. Again, I'm not sure whether that's the Democrats are able to make it that clear to the American people that that's what this is really about. But I've always been suspicious of the Ayn Rand kind of mentality of Paul Ryan, who seems to be, along with Mitch McConnell, enthralled with the very wealthy and willing to jump over hoops to do their bidding. I cannot understand why they feel they have such an obligation to the wealthiest Americans to give them.
That's definitely in the bill. If you look at the data from the Tax Policy Center about this, the top 1% of Americans would get 45%. Of the tax cuts in this repeal bill. And the top 0.1%, these are people who are making $5 million or more, would get an average tax cut of $250,000 in this bill. This, I may be wrong about this, but this is quite possibly the most regressive legislation in modern American political history. We have, of course, had laws before that have cut taxes for the wealthy, and we've had laws that have cut benefits for low-income Americans. I'm not sure, and since the New Deal, that we have ever had a piece of legislation that in the same bill has this magnitude of tax cuts to the wealthy and social benefit cuts to low-income Americans. And this really is an extraordinarily redistributive bill in that it takes the money that was being spent to help working Americans afford health insurance, takes that health insurance away from them, takes the subsidies away from them, takes Medicaid away from them, and gives that money to the wealthy in the form of tax cuts. It's absolutely a regressive bill of epic proportions.
But at this point, we don't know whether they're going to get away with it. But my understanding is that Ryan also wants to go after Medicare itself.
Well, this is, if you go back and, you know, it doesn't take much of a prophecy to predict this. All you have to do is go back and read Paul Ryan's budgets in 2011 and 2012, when he first put forward his budgets that contain all these elements, which is demolishing the Affordable Care Act, making devastating cuts in Medicaid, and attempting to privatize Medicare. That was in the original Ryan budget. He actually called for eliminating the government Medicare program and replacing it entirely with vouchers for private plans. In subsequent budgets, he had to back off that because of the political heat he took. But this has absolutely been on Paul Ryan's mind and his aspirations from the beginning. And this bill is only partly to repeal the Affordable Care Act. Much of this bill is designed to cut taxes for high-income Americans and to really devastate the Medicaid program. And let's remember that they're doing much more than rolling back the Medicaid expansion in the Affordable Care Act. They're proposing putting caps on Medicaid spending that are unprecedented in American political history, and that as each year went on, and the Congressional Budget Office report showed this, would hurt states more and more, and millions of people would lose Medicaid coverage as a result of these caps.
Well, just in closing, if they can't get their act together, they can still do an awful lot of damage. You know, as Ryan said a while back, Obamacare is still the law of the land. Well, if they can't get their act together, then won't they also spend the rest of the Trump's tenure, however long that might be, really undermining the law of the land if Obamacare still stays in place?
Yes, certainly the Trump administration has the ability to undermine Obamacare. They can do it by refusing to reimburse insurers for those cost-sharing reductions that help low-income people pay their deductibles and co-pays. If they do that, if they refuse to reimburse insurers, it could implode the individual insurance market in many states. So they could undermine the insurance exchanges. They could go the route of giving states waivers to impose work requirements on Medicaid enrollees and other kind of waivers. So there are lots of things that Congress and the Trump administration can do. This fight is not over, and we don't know yet what's going to happen in the Senate and what's going to happen in coming weeks. But you're correct that even if they fail, the longer-term battle over health reform and Obamacare is far from over.
Well, Jonathan Oberlander, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks so much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Jonathan Oberlander, a professor of social medicine and health policy and management at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, where he's also a professor in the Department of Political Science, a leading authority on the politics of healthcare and healthcare reform. He's the author of The Political Life of Medicare and co-editor of the three-volume series, The Social Medicine Reader, now in its second edition. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking with Marsha Geshen about her article at the New York Times, How Putin Seduced Oliver Stone and Trump.